Hello and welcome to Still Any Good, the podcast where we run the risk of ruining our childhoods by revisiting fondly remembered films. My name's Robert Johnson and I'm here with my own Welsh garage-dwelling Dr. Watson, Chris Webb.
Good evening, how are you?
I'm good. The podcast is afoot. It's not a surrealist statement.
But the podcast is afoot. No clues.
No clues.
How are you?
I'm good. Well, actually, I'm a bit poorly.
You do sound a little hoarse.
Yeah, just a Shetland pony.
Yeah.
I'll survive. And how are you?
I'm very well, actually. I'm not too bad at all.
Good.
I don't really know what to say. Like I said to you earlier, I've been doing some exercise, which is a bit unusual for me. So
yeah, looking quite svelte in your
Thanks very much.
In your garage there.
Yeah, there's more garage than you can normally see.
There is. It's less obscured.
Probably not a good thing.
It's like a little wraith in the shadows there. Of course, our last episode was the classic Yellowbeard, which was a decidedly about as popular as Yellow Snow, really. decidedly
as popular as beards, really. But...
Hey,
sorry, not yours, of course. Yours is lovely.
It's been a lot of time manicuring this.
I can tell.
Yes, Yellowbeard was a decidedly bad film, and so it's your choice, and what have you got for us this evening?
Well, hopefully I've chosen a good film, and this goes back to, I think it was released in 1985, but I saw it in Britain in 1986, mm-hmm. And it is, I'm going to give it the British title when it was released,
which
was Young Sherlock Holmes and the Pyramid of Fear.
Of you, begin an investigation.
Based on what?
Your imagination.
It was obviously a suicide.
Never trust the obvious.
Uncle didn't kill himself.
Before a lifetime of adventure came the adventure of a lifetime.
What's your name?
Holmes. Sherlock Holmes.
That was a girl.
Brilliant deduction, Watson.
Steven Spielberg presents Young Sherlock Holmes, directed by Barry Levinson.
There's a clever murderer on the loose, and I'm going to find him.
I might get caught, and that would mean trouble.
You would let trouble ruin an opportunity for adventure.
Elsewhere it was released as just Young Sherlock Holmes.
Mm.
I actually think the Young Sherlock Holmes and the Pyramid of Fear is a bit more appropriate, because for many reasons this is like a Harry Potter film without any of the fun in it.
I've written like Harry Potter quite a lot of times.
Yeah, yeah. Not to mention because Chris Columbus wrote it, of course.
There's a lot more reasons than that.
A lot more.
Yeah, Chris Columbus wrote it, and
yeah.
I think he may have passed that on to directing the first two Harry Potter films, because
yeah.
It's very, very similar in a lot of ways.
It almost looks like the same location.
It's those good old Billy Bunter-style public schools that they
use. Yeah, the actor who plays Watson, when he first appears in the movie, he looks exactly like a young Daniel Radcliffe on donuts.
He really does, doesn't he? He does that sort of pouty, looking upwards kind of thing that Daniel Radcliffe does in the first one.
Arriving at this new school, very Hogwartsy, and very, he's like Daniel Radcliffe if he ate Ron. You know, and...
Well, imagine the ginger shit. Which isn't a nickname for Ron.
Ooh, you're a ginger shit, you are.
You ginger shit. But you're absolutely right, because it is three friends, two male, one female, getting into scrapes, and their biggest fear is being expelled.
Yeah.
Very similar.
It is. And there's even a Draco Malfoy, a little blonde.
He's a good Draco.
He's a good Draco.
I like him.
And his name's Dudley, another Harry Potter
That's
reference.
That's right, yeah, yeah.
And you get introduced kind of one by one to the different professors and the different sort of teachers and things as well. And
yeah, with the slightly unusual names.
Yeah, there's the sort of sexy Snape, Professor Wraith, who's the fencing.
He is a sexy Snape,
he is
isn't
he? He's a bit of a sexy Snape, yeah.
And you get the slightly befuddled, beardy ones.
Yeah.
Who, of course, there's loads of those in Harry Potter.
Yeah, yeah. But we are getting ahead of ourselves, because...
We are, yeah.
Well, I think one thing we should probably begin with is you ran a really delightful Twitter poll for us, didn't you?
It was incredibly delightful. Oh my word. I had no idea what was going to happen.
And listeners, it was, of course, who's your favourite Sherlock Holmes? I voted for Robert Stevens from Private Life of Sherlock Holmes.
Oh, you went for the strokey beardy choice, of course.
Yeah, well, I only watched it a couple of years ago because I'd never seen it and I really enjoyed it. I thought it was cool.
It is a good film. Mm. It's very, very good. I went rather predictably for Jeremy Brett.
But with reason.
I do have a big preference also for Christopher Plummer's one-off as Sherlock Holmes as well.
Murder by Death?
Murder by Decree.
Murder
by Death. Murder by Death, that awful Agatha Christie spoof. Where Peter Ustinov does his hilarious Chinaman.
Yeah, whoops. Murder by Decree, yeah.
Murder by Decree, the Jack the Ripper Sherlock Holmes one, which has James Mason's Dr. Watson.
Oh, fantastic.
Where he famously says, "You squashed my pee."
I've got to watch this.
Have you not seen it?
I haven't seen it, no.
It's really good. It's really great.
I have to. A couple of years ago, I went through, you know, when I watched Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, I think it was when I was enjoying the, dare I say it, the BBC Sherlock.
First series was good, yeah.
And I managed to find a download of Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. I managed to find a download of 7% Solution, which I hadn't seen. But I didn't get Murder by Decree.
In the Jack the Ripper films that there are out there, it's probably the best one. Probably just above that time travel one with David Warner.
Oh, great. Oh, we love that one.
Yeah, I like that one
too.
That's really good. But yeah, so we did a Sherlock Holmes World Cup.
Yep.
And I didn't appreciate the power of the Benedict Cumberbatch fan club. They effectively hijacked the whole poll. When it was pointed out that maybe people should vote for somebody else, ooh, they got aggressive.
They did.
There was some nasty finger-pointing and accusations going on.
To be fair to them, that is the point of a poll, is people can vote for who they want. But it is the Twitter version of, I guess, sort of like bussing in kind of constituents.
Getting in the Teamsters to do the vote.
But I found it really fascinating because it may surprise the people out there that when we do run polls or sort of do anything online, we're not usually inundated by hundreds of engaged participants.
It normally peaks around about 20.
Yeah.
And this was about 500.
And all of a sudden I was looking at the numbers and it was 500. Yeah. And I was like, I found it very fascinating that...
Because most of them were presumably based in Europe. I went to bed with about 20 votes in the final. Woke up and there were about 450 votes.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was fantastic.
You have to admire the level of, you know, even for sort of a podcast on the other side of the world, relatively low profile, that they still mobilised their people.
Yeah.
And they Cumberbitch slapped us.
They bloody did. And I'm not casting aspersions on anyone who did the voting, but the two that were most vocal about the fact that we were maybe suggesting that other people cast votes, their little Twitter avatars were both of Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah, oh yeah, he's got a very, very...
They were proper hardcore.
Fierce following. Well, I'm gonna have a think about, because in a couple of days I was planning to do Who's Your Favourite Doctor Strange Twitter poll, and so maybe I'll think twice.
I was going to do a Who's Your Favourite Doctor Watson, but... Fuck that, no way. It's James Mason. There you go, I've done it.
Yeah. I haven't even seen it, no, I agree.
I was going to do it and deliberately leave out Martin Freeman.
Oh, God.
Just to see what they do.
Has he got a, sort of a following too? The free men? Well,
just by association of being standing next to Benedict Cumberbatch, I think.
Yeah, he's, by all accounts, a real prick, isn't he? In real life, Martin Freeman. Might have to edit that out, but it
doesn't matter because not a single voter downloaded any of our episodes, so I don't care.
Yeah, yeah, I've just doesn't seem like a nice person either.
No, I think he's a bit of a knob end. But I think we've given away who won.
Yeah.
Yes, the winner of the Who's Your Favourite Sherlock Holmes poll by about 90% was Benedict Cumberbatch. Well done, Benedict.
Well done, Benedict. Well done.
We'll be sending you a Still Any Good mug as an award.
I'm sure he'll appreciate that.
He'd love it.
He'll love it.
Mm. So, young Sherlock Holmes. And the Pyramid of Fear. Now, I think I did mention last time that one of the reasons that I just had to go and see this was watching Barry Norman's film 86, and they did a little featurette, which I managed to find on YouTube.
Oh, great.
Yep. And it's brilliant, because they really do concentrate on the stained glass man and the CG stained glass man.
Great.
And it's an interview with Dennis Muren.
Oh, cool. ILM.
Yeah, ILM.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he does say is, yeah, we made it using the Pixar machine.
Oh, cool. That's cool.
Brilliant.
Yeah,
brilliant.
Because I read somewhere that John Lasseter was integral in this. So,
I did check the end credits, and Lasseter is credited as one of the stained glass window animators. Yeah.
Now, there's a job title, you don't.
Yeah, it does say something like that. Because, of course, Pixar in those days were a graphics company. They weren't making features, they weren't making short films. They were owned by, I think, Steve Jobs and George Lucas were the owners of Pixar. Before they obviously branched out and became the behemoth that they are.
I actually thought the stained glass man held up, really.
I think it's brilliant.
I think it's really brilliant. I thought it still looked really cool. And part of that was just the way it was, the mise-en-scene, the way it was framed. But, I still thought if you saw this in a TV show these days, or a kids' TV show, sort of high-end kids' TV show, you'd think, fair enough.
Well, the fact that it's made out of something that's supposed to be painted glass, it looks absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
I don't think you could better it now. I think it looks fantastic.
Yeah, it looks really good.
But quite an interesting cast and crew in this film as well. As well as Chris Columbus being the writer.
Yeah.
When the credits start rolling, the first thing you see is it's a Henry Winkler production.
Yes, I've written here produced by Fonzie. Yes.
Yeah, so you immediately know it's going to be cool.
Yeah, the other thing that I remember, other than him being Fonzie, was he always produced MacGyver.
Is that right?
Yeah. So that was always that was always my big thing as a kid, was because produced by Henry Winkler. That was the one thing I kind of remember him for, other than being Fonzie. And so I was a little bit disappointed that, a mulleted Richard Dean Anderson didn't pop up here as Moriarty, perhaps. MacGyveriarty.
He could have helped making those funny flying machines and things like that.
Yeah, he? Exactly. He could have been Wax Flapper or whatever.
Uncle Wank Splatter. But director Barry Levinson.
Yeah, a very odd one for him.
That's weird.
Really strange for him. So he'd just come off Diner, which, a classic. And The Natural, which I actually quite liked as a kid.
I think it's very good. That's the one with the tree, isn't it, The Natural?
Yeah, with Robert Redford as the preternaturally gifted baseballer. Mm. And then, of course, he'd go on to do Good Morning Vietnam, Wag the Dog, which I really like, Bugsy. Career really starts going into the toilet sort of late 90s.
Well, he did Sleepers as well.
He did Sleepers, which is kind of good. And
I think Sleepers is all right, yeah.
Yeah. It's a real odd one for him.
Yeah, really. But of course, it's Amblin, so it's produced by Spielberg as well.
It's got that quality, stamp on it, isn't it? I'm not sure how it happened, if they roped Barry in or when he got attached, but
But also going through the credits, I did notice there's some other people that went on to very similar things as well. It says like animation supervisor was Stephen Norrington, who later went on to make The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen
and Blade, I believe. Did he?
And Blade, of course, yeah. But The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, not dissimilar in style to this.
No, it's that kind of slightly kind of steampunky mashup of influences in a Victorian setting.
So it feels like a few people involved in this sort of took it on to bigger and better and worse things.
No, it's a very interesting cast and very interesting crew. Less interesting cast. I mean, the most interesting thing for me about the cast is Brian Cox's son played Watson. He should have played Moriarty, Brian Cox.
That would have been good. That would have been a nice twist.
Yeah.
But we've got Nicholas Rowe playing Sherlock Holmes. So what was he in this? He was probably about 20 when he made this.
Yeah, but his voice seems to be breaking throughout the whole film, even though he's 19, 20, yeah.
But that means he must have been only about 4 years old when he made Don't Look Now.
Very good.
Thanks very much. But then we have Sophie Ward as Elizabeth, who just looks like Simon Ward in a long curly wig.
She does, doesn't she? She sort of reminded me of Kirsten Dunst's character in Interview with the Vampire, Claudia. You know, that kind of those golden sort of doll-like curls and things. And
I think she's very underused in this.
She is very, very underused, incredibly dull character. If this is the Casino Royale of Holmes movies,
which effectively it
really is, because spoiler alert, it's supposed to kind of explain why he's such a cold, distant, calculating person.
It literally gives him every mannerism that we know for Sherlock Holmes.
So,
literally every single one.
There's so much fan service that goes on throughout the whole
with the exception of drug addiction. Everything else has been paid lip service, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in the very last scene, he's given his pipe, his Deathstalker, his cloak. Yeah, if only someone had given him, like, a little mirror and a rolled-up kind of pound note, and he had a little snort, then it would have been complete.
Someone just turned up at the end and went, have a bang at this number. Let him go mad for it.
Yes, so Sophie Ward, the only other thing I kind of really remember her from as well is she was in Return to Oz as the nice face.
Oh, is that her?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, then we have some lovely but totally redundant and intrusive voiceover by Michael Gordon.
Yeah, there's just no need, is there?
He's like your totally obtuse uncle who opens the door and interrupts you having a nice time with someone else every 20 minutes. I mean, even that first scene, I mean, you can clearly see what's happening. Watson's arriving at a new school. He's a bit nervous. He walks in, he meets someone, but throughout the whole bloody thing, I just arrived at my new school, hopped out of my carriage, walked 20 paces, opened the door.
Opened the door, went inside, closed it again, walked approximately 20 steps north-northeast.
Shook off a bit of snow. Didn't want that to turn into water.
It's almost like a service for the visually impaired, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, is this the studio, the American studio, just not trusting the audience to understand? We have to point out that this is...
Yeah, it's all a bit Blade Runner, isn't it?
It's really, really, really bad. Yet, of course, as we mentioned, Alan Cox, totally, like, charisma-free zone. I don't know what else to say about him. He's just insipid.
Yeah, the thing I find really strange is there's loads of comments about Watson being overweight. It's fondness for custard tarts and stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But he's not fat.
No, he's a bit, you know, he needs to go for a run, but that's about it, you know?
Yeah, but he's not like Roland, is he? He's just a bit big-boned.
No. And then, of course, Nicholas Rowe, who, he's got that sort of haughty look about him, that kind of, you know, that kind of aquiline kind of nose. And
yeah, he's got a very good Holmes profile, doesn't he?
He's got a very good Holmes profile, but he's kind of like got dead eyes. I found him very wooden and very, very boring.
I thought he was all right.
Oh, he failed to hold my attention. And throughout the whole movie, they kind of talk about how emotional he is, and like, because the whole thing is that he was an emotional youth, and I was like, what emotions? Like, he's not really selling any emotions for me. Well, I just thought his delivery, or his, you know, his instrument, was it was just really flat and didn't hold my attention. And like I said, you know, even though it was 1920, every time he raises his voice, it sounds like he's going through puberty. His voice is breaking. Like when the game is afoot. Like, Nicholas, never mind your foot. Have your balls dropped?
Have you seen Mr. Holmes? It's that Ian McKellen one where he goes to the movies to see a Sherlock Holmes film. And he's played by Nicholas Rowe, which is probably the only interesting or exciting thing in that film. It's very dull.
It sounds really dull. He's a 93-year-old beekeeper.
Yeah, yeah, but most of it is just him going, I'm keeping some bees, and I've forgotten what I was about to say for about 2 hours. It's really dull.
But how does Nicholas Rowe do as a more mature Holmes?
Oh, he's good. He's fine. Okay. It's just a bit of a thrill to see him in it, to be honest. Because his acting career didn't really take off, did it? You know, he was a drug dealer in Lockstock, and that was about it.
Yeah, that's the only other thing I sort of remember him from. Actually, Jude Law's the best Watson. Come on, Jude Law's the best Watson.
Yeah, he's all right, actually.
Yeah.
So Watson's got out of the carriage, and he's arrived at the school.
Yeah.
He gets to his bed, and the first thing he sees is this tall, gangly fellow trying to master the violin. But he hasn't done it in 3 days, so that's it. He's going to smash it up. Arrogant twat.
Yeah.
Then he does one of his trademark deductions where he says, your name is James Watson, you've come from the north, your father's a doctor, and you like custard tarts. Which is just effectively what we've been waiting for. It's that process of deduction, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's the blunt excrement moment.
Bludgeoned to death.
Which is kind of fun. So he introduces himself as Sherlock Holmes. And this is now the first meeting between Holmes and Watson. It's obviously not strictly canon, but have you read any Sherlock Holmes?
Not really. No, I have to my, you know, I can't say I have. I mean, I could say I have. I'd be lying. But I know that you've read a lot of Conan Doyle.
Yeah, yeah, we've got a few of them. I first read Silver Blaze when I was about 14 and took it from there. Mm. But in those, the first meeting is in A Study in Scarlet.
Yeah.
It's almost like a sitcom. They literally do actually meet when they're both looking for somewhere to live, and they end up sharing a flat together, a bit like Men Behaving Badly.
Oh, that's cute.
But no, no, they met in, what's the name of the school?
Brompton Academy.
Brompton Academy. So that's where they meet, Brompton Academy. Mm. So they immediately strike up a friendship, and Holmes does his riddle about a bear.
And they really do just immediately strike up a friendship, don't they? There's no slow winning over. There's no kind of friction and playing off each other. And then by the end of it, they're like, actually, we're good mates.
Yeah, yeah. Holmes has done that because he's got no other friends.
Yeah.
He's done that thing that they're all Billy No Mates do. When there's a new kid at school, they latch onto him and go, we're best friends now, come on.
Yeah.
He's hijacked the new boy.
He has. But he's managed to kind of have a girlfriend of sorts.
Yeah, he's courting Elizabeth.
As mentioned, very underwritten, quite dull and one-dimensional, sweet kind of girl character.
Hmm. Hey, I tell you what we haven't mentioned, it's that pre-credit sequence.
Pre-credit sequence.
It's fantastic.
Oh, it's really good. The fog.
You see a man go to a restaurant, he orders a pheasant, then we hear this jingly bell. Then the pheasant turns into something from a horror film and kind of just attacks him. It's fantastic. I thought it was really brilliant.
It's really good. And then he, sort of in a panic, runs back home, goes up into his quarters, and his hat stand, which was is that what you call it? A hat stand? Yeah.
Yeah, he starts hallucinating hat stands, yeah.
Little serpents come and get him, and he's having a bad trip, really bad trip.
Mm.
And he jumps out the window.
Yeah, yes, great opening.
Yeah, it is good. It's really well done, that. And we go through the sort of Harry Potter meeting of the teachers, and there's the bumbly, fumbly one. Then, as mentioned before, sexy Snape, Professor Wraith, who is the teaching fencing.
Yeah, he's like an anti-Jedi, isn't he? Cause he's telling Holmes when he's fencing, don't trust your emotions.
Yeah. Too emotional. That's your problem. Which I couldn't quite gather that, because it wasn't like he was goading him and taunting him or anything. It was just...
It's quite controlled, really.
And he did. Well, he got a little hit on him.
He got a touche.
Yeah. I always used to want to do fencing when I was a kid, and just... wasn't an option in Gisborne.
In the 80s. We couldn't do it in Milford Haven either. Mm. Well, we'd occasionally sell stolen goods. But...
yeah, you could make fences and sort of rural properties, and that was it. And then, of course, we also meet Mrs. Dribb, who's Athena in Clash of the Titans.
Oh, she is. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah.
She's... Yeah. Susan Fleetwood, isn't it?
Yeah, Susan Fleetwood, yeah. It's the less musical one in the family. she had a rival band, Fleetwood Susan.
but then we meet Elizabeth's uncle, who I keep calling him Wank Splatter, which I think is a much, much better name. I don't like his name. It's not very Conan Doyle. It's kind of more like Dickens.
It's more very Dickensian. And there's another Dickensian name in there too, isn't there? Cragwitch.
Mm.
Yeah, Wax Flatter.
That's it, yeah.
Which, like, that's sort of like a D-grade J.K. Rowling. She pulled that out of the bottom drawer when she's getting desperate for names. It's not good.
It's a bit unobtainium, isn't it?
Very much.
But Ben Holmes does one of those... You know, he sort of regurgitates facts about Wank Splatter, about his history. Yeah. He's been here, he's done that. It's a very Holmes thing to do. And it's a good way of delivering exposition. Mm. You can do that with Sherlock, because that's something he does. Yeah. It doesn't really feel forced.
You can.
But then he's got a flying machine.
Yeah, he sort of has a kind of a Leonardo da Vinci type sort of thing.
Yeah. My first thought was, I wonder if that's going to come in handy later.
Yeah, it's... It's very much Chekhov's flying machine, isn't it?
It is.
Very much. Some would say the Starship Enterprise was Chekhov's flying machine.
Oh, very good. Very good. Big round of applause. But then the boys are at dinner and they're discussing what they're going to do when they grow up.
Yeah. Well,
I sort of half expected Leslie Phillips' hat to appear and go... Oh, hello. You're in Gryffindor. Ding dong. But it didn't, sadly.
No.
But they all want to be lawyers and doctors, except for Holmes, who just goes, I never want to be alone.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is the first thing you say to a bunch of teenage boys, isn't it? They just go, you fucking head case.
Unless I missed something, it doesn't quite articulate, maybe in the sort of hallucination later, but it doesn't quite articulate why he's got that need.
It's also strange because his parents have sent him away from home and he's got no friends. So, sorry, mate, you are alone.
Yeah, yeah, wake up. Okay, yeah, no one likes you.
And then we get the jingly bell again.
Yeah.
And then that dog with the funny name gives chase.
Uncas. It's a Last of the Mohicans reference.
Is it? Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And then we're into the church, this landmark scene. There's a vicar in there lighting candles. We hear that jingly bell. And now we know as soon as we hear that jingly bell, there's going to be trouble. There's this rattling, cracking sound. This knight, like a crusading knight from the stained glass window, bursts out and is alive.
And quite angry.
Very, very much, yeah. It's brilliant. It's so good.
It's well done. Yeah, and it looks good. It looks very good.
Even when we see behind him, because it's a window, he's got this like reversed face. You'd expect to see the back of his head, but you don't because it's a glass window. It's really great.
Yeah, it's cool.
That John Lasseter, he animated him. I think he should have gone places.
Yeah, yeah. And didn't he end up being a bit of a sex pest?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a shame.
I don't think he's really associated with much stuff anymore.
But didn't they kind of do the whole, oh, we're standing you down for like 3 months, but then kind of slowly they're bringing him kind of back and...
The Louis C.K. treatment, yeah. It's all very temporary.
Yeah, yeah.
But if he'd stolen a shirt from a shop like Winona Ryder did, his career would have been over for 20 years.
Yeah, all he did was sexually harass sort of 40 women over a period of 10
years. Yeah, that's all. So just miss out on one film and come back.
Exactly.
Just annual leave, really.
Yeah.
A little bit of politics there. But then the vicar runs out thinking he's being chased by a knight and he's squashed by a horse and carriage. Dead.
Yeah.
And for some reason, when Holmes reads about this in the paper, he thinks there's foul play and he's determined to solve it. But in the meantime, he's at school solving a crime. Dudley's challenged him to find this missing trophy.
Yeah.
And he's got 60 minutes to find it. So he says, the game's afoot.
Games afoot.
He just sort of wanders around the place, sort of fingering the soil for an hour. And he just goes, oh, c'est une vase.
I always found his deductions kind of underwhelming. And I know you're not supposed to get it until he explains everything. But I just never felt like, that's how you did it.
Well, that's it. He doesn't deduce anything. He just finds it.
Yeah, yeah. He says something about his foot being encased in snow was parallel to the trophy being encased in the vase or something, but
that's not a deduction. That's just deja vu. There's no powers of deduction at all.
It's intuition.
It's a fun idea, but he doesn't ever explain about how he came to that conclusion. And that's the fun of Sherlock Holmes. He tells you how he did it.
So basically, what Chris Columbus needed to do, or what perhaps Steven Spielberg needed to do, because he actually got Jeffrey Archer to do a polish on this to get...
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Jeffrey Archer did a polish on it.
Yeah. Well, talk about wank splatter. I read somewhere that Spielberg got, I think, two English writers to kind of do a pass on it, just to make sure it sort of rang true, the dialogue and the Englishness. But what he really needed to do was get someone clever who could do the, you could write your script and go, insert really clever explanation of deduction.
Yeah, absolutely. It's what Columbus has effectively done. He's just written, he solved it, all right?
Just take my word for it.
He did it, look. There's none of that step-by-step process, which is a lot of what Holmes is meant to be about.
Yeah, so there's the setup, but there's just no payoff.
It'd be like in Harry Potter if you just went, oh, Harry's magicked him back to life.
Well, that sort of does happen in Harry Potter, though.
Yeah.
He's sort of got magic back to life.
But then he goes to see Lestrade.
Now, who's the actor who plays Lestrade?
Now, I've got this written down. It's Roger Ashton Griffiths. Got a very distinctive face, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's got a piggish kind of piggish nose.
Yeah. Yeah, the only thing I remember him from is the boring episode of The Young Ones where he plays a devil called Orgo.
Ooh,
what was it?
God.
David Rappaport's Futumch.
Nice. I'll have to Google him. He had one of those faces that I feel like I've seen, but yeah, maybe it is in that episode of The Young Ones, yeah.
I'm going to call him Malfoy.
He really is Malfoy.
Yeah. He doesn't like the fact that Holmes has solved the mystery, so he fits him up. He fits Holmes up like a kipper and gets him set up for cheating in an exam, and that's it. Holmes is expelled.
This was a bit easy, I thought. It was just, I faked your handwriting. Because everyone must...
Yeah, anyone else in that exam room, Watson, for example, could have just gone, I saw him throw it on the floor.
Everyone just stay quiet.
And just everyone kind of know that Holmes doesn't just get good marks and tests, but he's constantly showing off about what an absolute know-all he is.
Yeah, that's why they don't like him.
He's so arrogant, precocious.
Yeah, he's like that 16-year-old girl who tells everyone about climate change, isn't he?
Yeah, he's like, yeah.
Posh Brits don't like intelligent children having the bloody cheek to demonstrate their intelligence. They don't like it.
How would she know how hot it is compared to previous years? She's only been around for 16 of them.
But then Holmes has one last duel with Wraith, but he's distracted by Wraith's humongous ring.
Yes, and then Wraith pulls his pants up, stands up.
But Holmes loses. Then we hear those jingly bells again, those jingly dementors, but they're going after Wank's bladder.
Yeah.
And we see some pretty nice stop motion gargoyles in a shop. Yep. This causes him to stab himself to death.
Yeah.
But the dementors dropped his whistle. So Holmes, having stopped to buy a pipe at the shop, he recognises that little whistle. So he takes it to like an Egyptian nightclub.
Yeah.
Where they're met by Nadim Sawala.
Yeah, Julius Sawala's dad.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, murdered in various Bond films. Mm. But the best thing he says is he asks the boys, "What can I get you boys? Drink, food, women?" To which Watson says, "Do you have any soup?" It really made me laugh.
And this is where Holmes just said, "Do you have any cocaine?"
Yeah. But instead, he gets out his dog whistle. They don't like it.
Yeah.
And so they say, "Get out or we'll kill you."
Don't they sort of do the whole Ramutep?
Ramutep. Yep, they do. But for some reason, he sort of identifies a bit of cloth from somewhere.
Touching cloth?
Yeah. That's right. And then after being threatened with a knife by Nadim Sawala, Holmes touches cloth.
After that soup.
Yeah, it's a bit too spicy. And after touching the cloth, he identifies it as being made in Wapping. So off they go to Wapping. They fall through some floorboards and slide down a big pyramid.
Yeah, or gets a bit sort of Goonies meets Temple of Doom.
Yeah, absolutely. And this may be why they got rid of that and the Pyramid of Fear, because obviously it's very similar to And the Temple of Doom.
Yeah, but were they trying to start a franchise with this? Makes sense, the whole
Yeah, they were, but because it made zero money.
Yeah, yeah, didn't do well at all.
But they see a sacrifice going on, this young girl, so Holmes yells, "Stop, she's alive!"
Yeah, it's quite horrible.
Yeah, it's awful, isn't it?
So they're pouring boiling oil.
Yeah, it's not nice.
On her, and she's screaming in agony. You see this young woman being wrapped in shrouds and
being mummified.
Being mummified, and then it's horrible because that's it, really, isn't it? She's dead, really. She doesn't get rescued or anything.
No, she's at it. But then they leg it. Holmes, Watson, and Elizabeth. And all three of them, they get a hallucinatory blowpipe in the neck. So they hide in the cemetery where they get these hallucinations of their own. Yep. Elizabeth's is a bit like the Thriller video with some undead clawing at it from the grave.
They're sort of like a crypt keeper, kind of from Tales of the Crypt, sort of.
Yeah, they're like that revenant in Creepshow, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, very much the creep.
Yeah. Watson, even though he loves his custard tarts, his worst nightmare seems to be having to be forced to fillet confectionery.
Yeah.
It's like, do you remember those chewing gum adverts from a few years ago? Those Antonio Banderas ones, where he's talking to these little animated donuts and stuff.
Oh, yeah, no.
Yeah, they've clearly taken their idea from this film, because those treats look exactly the same.
Yeah.
And then Holmes's worst nightmare, it just seems to be catching his father doing something.
Is he caught his father being a bit of a cad?
Enjoying some naughty lithographs, maybe.
Yes. He tells his mum. He's really caused a bit of an awkward domestic situation there.
Not the worst thing that could happen to anyone, though.
Yeah, sort of Sherlock sort of went into his father's wardrobe and underneath all his trousers and he found his naughty lithographs.
He's consulting detectives' wives, maybe.
Yeah. Sort of Hornbergs. Pipe magazine.
Rough shags. But yeah, because they're all very strong in character. They don't die, they're okay. So he goes to see Lestrade, but he's not interested. Now, the thing about this is, he's going to Lestrade. Lestrade keeps telling him to bugger off. If Holmes is that intelligent, why didn't he ever go, well, find another police officer then? He's not the only one.
But Lestrade's the one that appears in the books later, so it wouldn't be fan service if he went to someone else.
Yeah, but so, someone like Inspector Aberline would have been much more interested.
Yeah.
And he got some good drugs too.
Definitely. Some great skag. Yeah, it's just, I have to say at this point, I am flagging a bit at this point.
Okay. That second act, it does drag. But a lot happens. You know, Wanksblatt is dead. Elizabeth's got nowhere to go. Holmes has been expelled. Yeah. But, oh, I don't know. But then Mrs. Dribb says, take the dog to the pound. So that's your first sign she might be a wrong'un. But they run away. They find Freddie Jones, who's been hanging around a boys' boarding school suspiciously.
He's just doing his crawl delivery and...
Yeah. Clearly that giant stop-motion spider didn't kill him.
He recounts this tale. My favourite line of his there is, a young boy of Anglo-Egyptian descent. Yeah. But he sort of tells this whole story. It's almost like the in GoldenEye, kind of the Lyons Cossack story of why Alec Trevelyan became a baddie. It's kind of like this.
But then he says, and his sister.
Yeah. Ooh, who could that be?
Now, who's the only woman in this apart from Elizabeth?
Literally the only woman.
Yeah, I'm racking my brains.
Not Mrs. Dribb. Not Athena from Clash of the Titans.
But then he gets jingly belled and blowpiped.
That actually sounds like a bloody good time. What'd you do last night? Oh, I got jingly belled and blowpiped.
But Holmes manages to save him by being reasoned and logical. But then Holmes and Watson get attacked and Lestrade rescues them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Mrs. Dribb is sort of tending to their wounds and she's wearing a jingly bell. And Elizabeth says, it's you. Then her wig falls off and she starts to scream a bit. She's this screaming bald woman brandishing a small dog.
Yeah, she looks like Sinead O'Connor.
Yeah, she does, actually, yeah. But rather than tear up a picture of the Pope, she's holding a small dog.
Yeah.
But Wraith, too. He's a baddie, too. So they hypnotise Elizabeth, and they say she's going to be the fifth princess, the fifth sacrifice. Because there's some old myth or something or other that says if they sacrifice five princesses, it'll bring them back to power or something.
Yeah.
So they hypnotise her, and she's going to be sacrificed.
Because one of the things that we've sort of we haven't mentioned is Wank Splatter, when he dies, he says, Eta.
Eta.
And you hear this name, Eta, and of course, the young boy of Anglo-Egyptian descent, he is Eta. Mm. And that may come into play later.
It may. Then Holmes somehow has worked out that Wraith is Eta.
Yeah,
but he never explains why. He just says, how could I have been so foolish?
Yeah.
It's him. But again, there's no deduction. They've ripped another page out of the script, so it just says, yeah, he knows who it is.
You know, they could have done a clever sort of flashbacks of, yes, when he did this, that was, you know, and oh, that makes sense now. And you know, there's none of that because it's just not clever enough. If you're going to write any kind of detective whodunit mystery, especially a Sherlock Holmes, you need to have the mechanics of the deduction worked out.
Then they don't know how to get back to their pyramid, so then at last we get that flying machine.
Mm-hmm.
They fly all over London. They nearly crash into Big Ben. Do they do that silhouette across the moon?
I don't know, because I just...
Well, they should have done. I mean, it is Amblin.
I just remember thinking, when you on paper list the things that happen in this film, it sounds quite fun and exciting. And this also sounds like, quite fun and exciting. And it just wasn't. It was just left me really cold. It was just like, oh, okay, so now they've jumped in a flying machine. It's not like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Get in that flying machine and fluff, It was...
But there was, again, though, thanks to Watson, one line of dialogue that really made me laugh.
Oh, good.
They nearly crash into Big Ben, and Watson goes, oh, my God, it's nearly 12:30. Should have been more of that.
Yeah, that is good. Yeah,
very funny.
That is very, very good.
But the flying machine crash lands onto some ice, because luckily the Thames has frozen over, and they get to that pyramid. Mm. And it's full of Egyptians. They're chanting because it sounded like frangipane, frangipane. They're just impatient for dessert.
Are they Egyptians, or they're just kind of they're the homeless and
it's the homeless and other weak dregs of society. Basically, poor people who are easily indoctrinated into terrorist cells.
Basically, it was just one little last dig at the classes. It almost sounded like the start of Carmina Burana, you know, that sort of...
Oh, the old Spice advert, yeah.
It kept sort of sounding like it was going to get into that, and then it never quite did. But yeah, I don't know what they're saying.
Something the film could have had, just to elevate it a bit, would have been a John Williams score, but sadly it doesn't.
It doesn't, and it really would have helped. It would have helped. And it's the perfect, like, you can conjure it up in your mind, the Victorian setting, the adventure, the mists, and the derring do. I mean, God, yeah, it lends itself to a John Williams score. And what did we get? We got bloody...
I can't even remember who did it.
Oh, it's totally forgettable.
It's not even like a Jerry Goldsmith or a Bill Conti.
Yeah.
But they're at the pyramid. Elizabeth's about to be sacrificed.
Mm.
But luckily, Holmes, with his knowledge of physics and geometry, he brings down the ceiling and sets fire to everything. And then Wraith punches a teenage boy with glasses in the face.
We've all wanted to.
So he does that. Yeah. He smacks Watson in the face.
Mm.
But they're out. And they think they're safe because they think Wraith has gone, but he comes back with a gun and he shoots Elizabeth.
Yeah, he's trying. To be fair, he's trying to shoot Holmes. Elizabeth gets...
Yeah, but she throws herself into the path of the bullet.
To be fair to Wraith, he does say, damn, or something.
Yeah, yeah, I only meant to murder your uncle. Sorry about that.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to sacrifice you later, to be fair.
That's right. That's a very good point. I was quite surprised that she did actually die, because that doesn't normally happen in films like this.
Well, it's the Vespa Lind thing, isn't it, really? It's the loss that calluses his heart for...
Yeah, but Casino Royale isn't a kid's film. This is. It's just odd to see the love interest get murdered like this.
Yeah.
I sort of almost expected to see her turn up at the end and go, ha-ha, I wasn't really dead.
Yeah. She actually, to give her her dues, she does... go out with a smile at the end there when she says I'll be waiting for you, you'll be late as usual, and then she smiles and then so is that really what you'd be, would be on your mind as your life is ebbing away?
Not even like an I love you or something like that. It's just a little dig at the end to remember her by.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she's dead. Holmes and Wraith have a little sword fight.
A little duel.
But this time Holmes bests him, and Wraith falls through the ice. Gone.
Does the little outreached hand as he sinks into the polystyrene all around.
Yeah, yeah. And then we're back at the school. Holmes is going home for Christmas with Mycroft.
And this is where kind of every other little bit of fan service just gets sort of shoehorned in at the end there. He's wearing Wank Splatter's Deerstalker. He's got Wraith's cloak on. It's like the skin of the leopard. Watson gives him the pipe, which all of a sudden he decides, yeah, right. Probably takes it home, actually, and finds a big stash of cocaine in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And a little spoon to hold over the fire.
Yeah. Then he sort of jumps in his carriage and sort of, see you later, Watson. And then Michael Horden comes in going, is that moment I realised that I was sure in my bones, in my waters, that I'd come to see Holmes again one day. And I never got the opportunity to thank him. And I just, why did we need that, you know? But
slightly unnecessary, yeah. But did you stick around for the end credits?
Yeah, I did, because when I did see this movie when I was a child, I couldn't bring myself to enjoy it because I remember very vividly that they played it on a Sunday night at the end of the summer holidays, the day before school. That whole day, you know, you're just filled with dread because you've had 6 weeks of holidays and just couldn't enjoy anything. And so I remember this being on, and I remember at the very end of it, the little post-credits sting, beating Marvel films by a good 20-odd years.
Yeah, yeah. Because I'd seen the film before, obviously, but I'd never watched all of the credits.
Mm.
I'd watched the horse-drawn carriage and thought it was just Holmes riding through the country.
Mm.
But this time I did stick around.
Of course, it's not Holmes, is it?
No, it's not. We see somebody checking into like an Alpine lodge or a hotel.
Yeah.
They write their name in the book and he writes, Moriarty.
Yeah.
And we look up and it's Wraith.
He's got a little scar on his cheek and he cocks an eyebrow knowingly. It didn't really make sense in a lot of ways, really. I mean, it's certainly not canonical to Conan Doyle, was it? Because Moriarty was kind of an established intellectual figure, wasn't he? written books and things. And
but speaking of being non-canonical, which is a very difficult thing to say because I've had one whiskey.
Non-Arthur canonical.
Conan's anonymous. They do take great efforts to say this isn't canon. There are a lot of disclaimers in the credits saying this isn't an original work by Arthur Conan Doyle. No offence intended, fans.
Please don't sue us. Yeah.
Yeah, we've just done this. But it's probably more canon than the Guy Ritchie one or even the Cumberbatch BBC one. It's an odd thing to do, I thought.
It was unnecessary, I would have thought. Yeah, because they bookend it with those disclaimers, don't they? They're one at the start and then another one at the end going, oh, yeah, Arthur Conan Doyle didn't write this. We've just speculated what might have happened. He never really went into their youthful times, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, because obviously this is pre-Twitter, so there was no worry about 500,000 arseholes writing a petition.
Yeah. And then it sets it up nicely, of course,
For a sequel that didn't happen because it bombed at the box office.
They were hoping for a Quantum of Sherlock or something like that.
Yeah, because what's the housekeeper called? I forget. And Mrs. Hudson would have evidently turned up in the second one as well.
Yeah, doing the Albert Finney role in Skyfall. So, young Sherlock Holmes and the Pyramid of Fear. Chris, still any good?
I still enjoyed it.
Good on you.
In spite of everything that we've said, I still thought it was okay. Not as good as I remembered.
Yeah.
I thought it was this big joyous romp.
Yeah.
Which was intelligent and kept me on the edge of my seat the whole time. It certainly wasn't that, but I still liked it. It was lacking in quite a lot of ways. The pacing, even the way it was shot, didn't look as grand as I thought it could have done. It still looked a little bit cheap and TV movie in places. And as we've said, some of the performances were left wanting. What about you?
I really wanted to like this. Yeah, it's got all the ingredients of, like you say, a romp, a really good adventure. It's got sort of that steampunky inventions. It's got cool special effects, action. It's got the whole prequel thing. And there are real, really brief moments that I thought were quite good, but I just did not enjoy this. The actors, I thought they were on a par with Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, the first out.
That's a terrible thing to say.
I kind of wanted to like Nicholas Rowe because I kind of remembered him as being this cool, steely Holmes and quite well cast, and he had that look. But I just thought he was really wooden. And Alan Cox, I just totally forgettable. Every other character was shit. I quite like Wraith. I thought he was quite good. But again,
he's promising.
He sort of disappears for a lot of it. I found the plot kind of confusing. There were bits where I just wasn't sure why something was happening. And I think, in part that was because, like you say, sort of Holmes just intuits things rather than deducts them.
And the whole thing is rather silly.
It is very silly, but I mean for a rich brew that has sort of Egyptian cults and hallucinations and action and intrigue, it was very, very dull. I thought stagey and I just kind of couldn't wait for it to end towards the end there.
I can understand that.
So yeah, I mean all the ingredients are there, but I think there's probably a reason that it tanked at the box office.
I can see where you're coming from.
So, yeah, it was a pyramid of shit for me.
So, I suppose we should talk about the next one.
Well, I've got quite a special next one, haven't we?
We do. I'm not going to give it away.
Oh, we're not? Okay, all right.
No, let's not give it away. Right. But our next one is, believe it or not, our second birthday.
Wow.
Come the middle of July, we will have been doing this for 2 whole years.
Wow, that's amazing.
Which means more than a year of it, I've been doing it in my garage.
Yeah. I can't even picture you outside of the garage now. Oh. It's like the bubble boy. You're like the boy in a bubble, but you're in a garage.
Yeah, I do never leave this room, actually.
Yeah, actually.
When I say I do exercise, I just run around the garage. Yeah.
Is that why you're holding up a sign saying, help me, call the police?
Yeah. I've got a poster of Rita Hayworth over there, which I'm occasionally hiding behind to dig a hole in. So in about 30 years' time, I'll just get covered in shit. That'll be it. I'll be free.
Excellent. Well,
but yes, our birthday episode. We do have something planned.
Yeah.
But we won't reveal what it is because I think it's quite a nice surprise and it's quite exciting.
Oh, great.
So all will be revealed when it happens.
Fantastic. I look forward to it. Oh, well, thank you, Chris.
Thank you very much. Let's do some normal housekeeping if you want to get in touch with us. We're on Twitter at StillAnyGoodPod.
Instagram, StillAnyGoodPod.
We're also on Facebook, StillAnyGood. And if you want to email us, StillAnyGood@gmail.com.
And all your correspondence is welcome unless you are a Benedict Cumberbatch freak.
Well, but disclaimer, if you are a Benedict Cumberbatch freak, if you are a Benedict Cumberbatch, I'm going to say it properly this time and edit the whole fucking lot out. If you are a Benedict Cumberbatch, no, if you like Benedict and you download it, you're more than welcome. That's fine.
Duke Benedict?
Anyway, I'm going. That's good.
All right.
Thanks very much. See you then. Bye.
See you.